pile of pike pulled from the well-stocked lake. Manrique squatted among the bastards, cutting lemons. He'd seemed relieved to have a task to perform. Lucas had arrived between the lemons and the court, and now waited a quarter turn around the lake with Fuchtus, both carefully placed by Crafty. The demon drew the noble's fascination, while the handsome man invited them to share the hoof's catch with all the right manners and gentle words. The hoof's instructions were simple.
"Be only who you are," Alamra told them. "Many will hate you. Most will fear you. Few will speak to you, but all will approach you on our terms."
"So we can serve them?" Thresher challenged. Alamra placed a tender hand on her sister's face.
"Imagine we were all in the lots. Would these humans know how to fend for themselves? Would they survive a day in our Ulwandulas? You have lived in their world, Dacia. You survived. They can never boast the same. If this were the lots and you gave them food, you would not be serving them. You would be saving them. They will think of you, of us, how they will. Yet we know our power. Do not give that up by continuing to believe the falsehood that they are better than you."
And now they came, the boldest giving Fuchtus a final goggle and a nod to Lucas, before approaching the half-orc's cook fire. Oates stood waiting. It was his duty to hand the fish over. He tried to tell Alamra that Sluggard would be a better choice, but she had smiled at him and given a shake of her head.
"It should be you."
He reckoned she had reasons, but he hadn't pressed to know them. He could give a fish to a blue blood without looking like a slave. And if any treated him like one, he'd give a glower that would make them shit their silken hose or piss their skirts. A thrice blood didn't need to raise a hand or say a word to make a frail think twice about being a haughty cunt. Hells, Oates reckoned he'd just worked out Alamra's reasons. The first to come were a couple with locked arms. He had some gray in his hair. She looked barely out of girlhood. Father and daughter, or wed, Oates couldn't say. They each took a skewer wordlessly, the woman casting skittish eyes at Oates, while the man seemed intent on Manrique. The prince kept to his lemons. The couple moved off. Oates watched them, curious to see if they would actually eat. He snorted when the man took both skewers and flicked them into the trees. Perhaps they feared poison. Oates couldn't fault them that caution. Or perhaps they had simply gorged themselves in the pavilions during the procession to the forest and had no stomach left. Either way, they were only the beginning of mute nobles tossing good food. Duke Hernan of Bashiduras was the first to speak. He looked smaller out of his armor, but only by a cunt hair, the heavy layers of his court attire serving well enough in place of the plate. His bearded face was no less grim as he took the skewer from Oates, looking him square. "I have a hunger," he said. Oates gave him a second skewer. "You need more? Just hunt a few paces into the trees." Hernan gave a fierce smile and walked away. The last man to approach was the Duke's opposite. Small, narrow-shouldered, and pot-bellied, his clean-shaven face shot through with the tiny webbed veins of a drunkard. He greeted Oates with an easy nod and took the fish, but did not hurry off as the others had. Instead, he remained where he was and ate. He hummed appreciably with the first bite, pinched a smaller morsel, pushed it into his mouth, and sucked the juices from his thumb. All the while, he looked at Sluggard, who seemed careful to keep his back turned as he tended to the fish on the fire.
"This is good," the man said, smiling as he lifted the skewer. "Simple. It's been a span since I've had aught but rich food. The spices, the sauces, they can be too much for me. But this is good."
Sluggard had tensed as the man spoke.
"You are the gray bastards?" the man asked easily, continuing to eat.
"True bastards," Oates replied.
"I saw your hogs. They were quite the diversion for the court.
Most don't know what they're looking at. Just great, tusked swine. But I have an eye for bearded deer hogs. I used to run them in another life. And you have some impressive animals. One reminded me of the best hog I ever owned. Looks exactly like him, in truth. So much so that out of reflex I called out to him. Paula, I said. And do you know, the hog's ears twitched and he looked up to me. Odd fucking thing to happen.
Sluggard stood and turned around.
Enough, Barasa.
The man made a mummery of surprise, taking it so far he dropped what was left of his fish.
Sebastian? He said, with unconvincing shock. Could it be you? Martyred Madre, look at us. Reunited. And here, in the midst of the Queen's court. In her very city. Our dreams rendered true. Why do you just stand there? First no farewell, and now no embrace?
Barasa spread his arms, but the gesture was far from affectionate. Sluggard didn't move. His jaw was tight. How did you find me?
Find you? Barasa said, his puzzled expression shedding all sham.
He dropped his arms.
Herathos's cock, Sebastian. I abandoned the search for you long ago. What need had I for a runaway Carnivale rider, even the best Carnivale rider, when I no longer owned a troop? I gave it up when Her Majesty made me master of Vittlers. Thank all the gods that smiled on me.
A place at court, Sluggard said dully. You did get all you wanted. More, it seems.
Barasa's moist eyes danced. Perhaps I should thank you. It is as if your flight south lifted me up. I never thought a runaway mongrel on a stolen hog would bring me to such fortune. Not after their disappearance brought me damn near to ruination. But I found that a desperate Barasa is a fearless Barasa. And a fearless Barasa prospers.
I wager he does, Sluggard replied. The crowd around the lake began to stir, their attention drawn to the path. A pair of massive armor-clad men in umber tabards walked side by side, each bearing a poleaxe. Their helms were fashioned into the likeness of a fearsome bull, complete with sweeping horns. Hells, they were bigger than the Duke. Another pair followed, and a third.
The Order of the Minotaur, Barasa said.
He turned back to the bastards and winked,
affectionately called the Queen's Bulls.
They actually fucking minotaurs? Culprit asked, causing Barasa to laugh.
No, of course not. Just Her Majesty's most loyal and deadly cavaleros. She arrives.
She chilled Oates to the bone. She came in plate similar to the bull's, though she wore no helm, and her tabard was white, decorated with a red heart pierced by a golden banner. Oates had seen that decoration before, on the shield of the woman atop the heap. The woman who nearly killed him.
The Queen's a maiden spear? He said, giving voice to his surprise.
The sight of the weapon in her gauntleted hand caused the scar in his chest to ache. Barasa's laughter fermented into a chuckle.
Ingrazia Bracara is the matron spear, head of the Blessed Sisters of Magritta, and Her Majesty's constant protector.
The Queen's bulls split and fanned out around the lake as the matron spear strode forth. The gathered nobles made room for her, shrinking back from the sharp, vigilant motions of her head. Oates couldn't discern much of her face from across the lake, but her hair was dark and cut short. And Grazia Bracara lifted a strong voice.
Her Royal Majesty, Orsaria Trastorius, Queen of Hisparta and the Stripdiles, Countess of Ulwandulas, Lady of the Upper and Lower Marches, Sovereign Grand Master of the Ancient Order of the Minotaur, devoted of Blessed Magritta, favored daughter of the gods.
The woman who came down the path didn't look much different from the dozens of others who had filed past Oates
to get fish and give bland looks. There weren't even a crown on her head, though her cape was trimmed with miniver. If Manrique and Ursaria shared blood, his height must have come from his mother, for the queen was stocky. And Grazia knelt, and the nobles followed. Crafty and Alamra did as well. Likely a precaution against attack, the queen's bulls remained standing. Fuctus, too, Oates noticed. There was something defiant in the set of the demon's corded back. The bastards did not kneel. Those still squatting by the fire got to their feet instead. Manrique offered neither deference nor defiance. He stayed sitting, cutting the lemons. But his hands were trembling with such violence, Oates feared his knife would slip. The queen stood for a small span. Oates couldn't see her eyes, but he suspected they moved over the crowd. They might have settled on him, his brethren, noting their lack of obedience. He couldn't be certain. At last, she stepped to Ingrazia, and the matron spear rose. This must have been some signal the court was trained to follow, for the nobles stood in a rustle of heavy cloth. Ursaria gestured to Crafty and Alamra. They approached, and it was hard to say which did it with more fluid ease. Oates didn't catch what was said. Only Crafty's voice carried enough to reach him, but was little more than a garble of good-natured sounds. The queen laughed. It wasn't a boisterous thing, but her head tilted back with merriment, her mouth smiling and open. "Fucking Crafty," Polecat said. "No," Thresh said. "That was Rue's doing." The queen turned and walked to one of the benches. She sat, inviting the mongrel envoys to join her. The gathered nobles made it difficult for Oates to see them. "I must go," Barasa said as he began to move off. "It gladdens me to set eyes upon you again, Sevastian. A pleasure I'd not thought I'd ever get."
"Shit," Culbert said when the man was gone. "He doesn't like you at all."
"That a worry, slug?" Oates asked.
"No."
Thresher looked concerned.
"Sluggard."
Sluggard turned to her and smiled, hunkering back down.
"All's well."
Oates had a mind to pull him aside, but decided against it so he could focus on Alamra. Her palaver with the queen went on for a long time.
"Reckon we can eat," Oates said at last. There was nothing else to do. None so much as spared the hoof a glance now that the queen was here to draw every boot-licking eye. The ensorcelled animals continued their dull-witted meanderings as the day wore on. The nobles appeared under the same spell. Oates began to see the strain in their smiles. In ones and twos, they all made their way over to the queen, kneeling once more before her bench and rising to share a brief exchange of words. Only Duke Hernan was invited to sit, his bulk blocking the queen from Oates's view. Alamra sat on Ursaria's other side and was also eclipsed, making Oates a little nervy. He wasn't alone in his agitation. Lucas kept casting vexed looks at Manrique, but the prince never met his eye. Finally, Lucas came to the fire in a poorly hidden fume. He leaned down by Manrique's ear.
"You must go over," he hissed. "How long do you intend to malinger here?"
The prince said nothing. The lemons had long been exhausted, leaving him to poke at the coals. Lucas steamed.
"Damn it, Rique! Why do you do this to yourself? To me?"
Manrique continued to sulk. With a silent snarl, Lucas seized the front of the prince's shirt and shook him. Manrique looked up, startled by the sudden roughness, his unfortunate features twisted by injured alarm. Oates and the others tensed as Lucas berated the prince in a furious whisper.
"You'll not do this, do you hear? You came back. You brought this. Now rouse yourself, damn you!"
Lucas released Manrique as quickly as he'd grabbed him and straightened, casting a swift look around to see if his temper had been witnessed. Oates was fair certain it had. These nobles were skilled at spying over their cups. Manrique kept his pained gaze on Lucas.
"Will you go with me?"
"You know I can't," Lucas said, refusing to look at Manrique. The prince looked back to the fire, gave a small, forlorn nod, and stood. Slowly, he shuffled off, eyes downcast.
"Why can't you go with him?" Culbert asked, giving Lucas a sour glare.
"I'm a commoner," the man replied. "The only ones with less of a place here are you half-breeds."
Manrique was now winding his way through the crowd. Most of the nobles didn't bother to budge, forcing him to thread his large, awkward frame between their little groupings. His back drew mocking smiles and whispered japes.
"Fuck this," Oates said, and moved to catch up. His bulk and swift pace caused a few gasps, and one frail dumped wine down the front of his jerkin in his hurry to get out of the way, though Oates was nowhere near to knocking into him. He saw the queen's bulls begin to move, but he reached Manrique's side the next heartbeat. The prince shot him a startled look, his mouth opening, but any words were trapped along with Manrique's feet. Oates halted next to him, and the bulls paused in unison. They were less than a stone's toss from the queen, but she continued her conversation with Crafty and Alhambra. Behind her, the matron spear stood watchful. It was her raised hand that had stopped the bulls, Oates saw now. Oates gave Manrique what he hoped was an encouraging look. Swallowing hard, the prince took a pair of steps forward, and it was as if he crossed some unseen line that made him visible.
"Manrique,"
the queen said, breaking off her conversation seamlessly. Oates was close enough now to see her mouth was a little crooked, but it lent a charm to her earnest smile.
"I am joyed to see you."
The prince began to kneel.
"Oh no, stop that,"
Ursaria said, standing.
"It pains me to watch big men try to stoop so. Unless it is our treasured Duke of Bashadouris, for it keeps him nimble."
She caught a coy look at Duke Hernan, who dipped his head with a smile. Ursaria stepped to Manrique and took his hand in hers. He towered over her, a bashful oaf faced with a bold and bright-eyed woman. What Oates could see of her hair through the strung pearls and complicated twists was deep chestnut.
"Tell me, Manrique, how fares your bull and the lions? I have longed to see them."
They flourish, Majesty. Thank you."
"Ursaria," she told him, pointing a scolding finger. "Or dear sister, I'll have no other from you."
She stood on her toes to whisper, though it was clear she still wished for all nearby to hear.
"Unless that dry old fulminator Barrientos can hear, then you must drown me in titles for both our sakes."
She gave a tickling laugh, returning to her heels and her confident tone.
"Thankfully, our Lord Consult loathes celebration, so he will not darken our day. Do you enjoy yourself, Manrique?"
"Yes,"
Manrique replied, the word flat and meek. Ursaria's mouth turned down in sympathy.
"I know this puts you ill at ease. I did try to make it tolerable. There is nothing to be done about the court, I fear. They are like children, always underfoot and demanding fresh distraction. They will tire of this wood soon, do not fret, and then it shall be yours entirely. You may retreat here whenever you wish. I know how you hate the lists. Oh, and the bullfights. More unavoidable trappings of your return. The people wish to celebrate, and they are unimaginative in their tastes."
"I understand," Manrique said. "It is a kindness. I am grateful."
The queen placed a hand on his face, lips pursing with affection. Her eyes moved now to Oates.
"Another man that would be tortured by kneeling," she said, detaching from the prince. "Or does my use of man offend?" "Mongrel sits well with us, your majesty,"
Alhambra said.
"It is how we name ourselves and each other." "You are a thrice-blood?"
Ursaria asked Oates.
"Yes."
"He is called Oates," Manrique put in. "He leads the true bastards."
"No," Oates said. "Our chief leads the hoof, and Alhambra speaks for her."
"Yes," the queen said, "and well, too. Though I will confess I have been slightly deafened by envy.
I have never seen such beauty, and that is to say nothing of her skin.
Ursariah cut a playful smile at Alamra.
Your majesty flatters me and is too kind. A blind man would be enthralled by you, girl,
Ursariah said, though there was little difference in their age. Somehow it wasn't a slight.
Now, Oats. Alamra has told me some of Ulwandulas, but she admits to being a newcomer. Am I right to assume you were born there?
I was.
Will you sit and tell me of it? The queen said, returning to the bench. Duke, make room for them. Manrique.
She patted the bench to her right.
Oats, sit beside him there. Would you take wine?
Oats saw a cup in Alamra's hand, so he nodded. A servant brought him a brimming goblet. The queen proceeded to ask questions, small, captivated questions. She looked him squarely and never interrupted nor grew restless as he answered. He tried to do what Alamra said and be what he was, nothing more. The first time he said fuck, the duke bristled, but the queen did not so much as blink. As she guessed, Oats had spent his entire life in the lots, an entire life spent hating the crown, the frails, the boot of Hisbartha. He never reckoned he'd ever set eyes on those who wore that crown, that boot. In his youth, the words king and queen were little more than curses uttered by the old riders like Creep and Warbler and the Claymaster. The orcs were the enemy, the true threat. Hisbartha was more of an annoyance, frails on foals. That had changed in recent days. The bastard shedding the gray to become true had also changed the notion of the hoof's enemies. Hells, they were fighting a war with Hisbartha now, not simply grousing about the kingdom and the near useless presence of its cavaleros. Oats had led raids into this land, killed its soldiers, and still he'd never given a thought to those who ruled them. Not a solid thought, one that considered their manner, their minds. He'd never pondered what the queen would be like. But if he had, he'd never have expected her to be kind. Chapter 32 Oats knew he was dreaming. It was unlikely the queen of Hisbartha would be astride his cock, her back leaning against him as she pushed herself up and down. And it was a fair shot from probable that Alamra would have her head between both his legs and Ursariah's, doing all manner of delight with her tongue. Even if those acts could happen, the three of them wouldn't be in the bastard's bunkhouse in Winsome, a place Oats hadn't seen in a year and was abandoned besides. So, a dream. One of them rare ones where he could recognize it but not wake, and had almost as much control of himself as he would were this real. It was a trap, luring him with the pleasure before seizing him with the strange. Suddenly, Alamra was commanding the queen away, saying it was time to change Oats's bedclothes. His bunk became Bermudo's huge bed in the Castile, and he was hurt again, bandaged and soiling himself. Thistle was angry with him, but he couldn't tell if it was because he was fucking the other women, both vanished, or because he'd pissed the linens. He got up, and it was a moment before he realized he was awake. The bed he'd risen from, the one next to Hood's, in their shared room in the prince's city house.
Bad dream, the thin voice slid through the small span of murk between them.
All them nobles' dishes, Oats muttered. Thankfully he hadn't pissed the bed in the waking world. In truth, he wasn't certain it was the food, though it had been excessive and exotic. The bastards hadn't known much of what they were eating during the feast that closed the day. They had all sat at the tables on the terraced hill. The queen occupied the highest step, inviting Alamra, Crafty, and Oats to dine with her, along with Manrique. The queen's bulls took up places on the sides of the upper rows, while the matron's spear stood behind Ursariah. Having the woman at his back made Oats more than uneasy. Oddly, he felt better for having Fuctus there, standing sentry behind Crafty. The rest of the bastards were given the bottom step, and Oats noted none of the court was sat with them. During the lavish and lengthy meal, minstrels and jugglers and mummers had provided a never-ending parade of diversions on the tourney field below.
Oats had been careful with the wine, but Rue had given no instructions about the food. The strong spices and heavy sauces must have conspired with the long span in the Queen's company to concoct the dream. Had to be the answer, for he'd not felt one pang of desire for her during the night. Hells, he'd hardly spoken to her, and couldn't even look her way without craning his neck fully to the left. As for Alamra, a mongrel would have to be dead not to want her, but it weren't something Oates had dwelled on over much, especially lately. Fucking dreams. Fucking dreams. No sense trying to unknot them. The only certainty with this one was it had woken him fully. Sleep wouldn't be returning. Times like these, it was best to flee the bed, lest it become a pitiless altar for a tossing body. Moonlight distilled through the shuttered windows gave his mongrel eyes enough detail to grab his breeches. His cock was still more erect than not, that vexing middle ground of swollen where it won't fit comfortable in the breeches' crotch nor down a leg. Grimacing, he tucked it away best he could and left the room. The door opened out onto the veranda on the second floor. Oates stood for a long while, leaning against the smooth, cool stone of the railing, looking up at the square of night sky above the inner courtyard. A pair of strong desires struck him at the same moment. The first was a need to piss. The second, to see Ugfuck. He went barefoot and shirtless down the stairs. The forecourt was silent, cleared of the tubs. Oates crossed to the trees standing near the wall fronting the street and loosed his water. The house had a pair of fancy guard robes, but pissing in the open and better-smelling air felt more like home. With the stable's few stalls full, Ugfuck was too big to fit inside, so he'd been left next to the building outside. The hog had been asleep, but roused himself and was nudging Oates' leg before his stream was done. Oates laughed. "Gonna make me wet my feet, Ug. Damn it." He finished and laced his breeches, turning to rub Ug between the eyes. They ambled back toward the stable, nothing but a dozen strides. A thick pile of straw had been put over the cobbles for Ug to bed down on. The big pig flopped on his side and loosed a heavy breath. Oates sat next to his head and scratched his jowl. "How in all the hells did we end up here, Ug?" he said at last. The hog didn't even grunt. "I got no answer either. Tonight I saw a man in a mask. Looked like some kind of marsh bird with a long, curved beak, and he was juggling torches. Another, he didn't wear a mask, just talked loudly in a foreign tongue for a long span, kept doing all these big gestures with his arms. No notion what he was saying, but some of the noble frails on the tables below us were crying. Ruse said it was Anvilis poetry. Bunch of mummers ran about with puppets after, made them fuck and kill each other. At least with that, I understood why the frails were laughing. You reckon that's what it is up here? Blue bloods gorging themselves, crying and laughing at jesters? Hells, to think how many nights my mother struggled to feed us all." A hot smell struck Oates' nostrils, one he knew well. "You ain't been starving, you farting fuck," he told Ug, leaning to pat the hog's belly. The gate from the street rattled and opened. Oates tensed, but relaxed when he saw Lucas stumble through. He'd not returned to the house after the feast, where he'd sat on the lowest tier with the hoof, but gone off alone once they were within the city walls, pushing the banner at Manrique and spurring his horse into a side street. The prince had offered no protest, and merely watched him ride away. Polecat had reckoned Lucas was off to the brothels, and suggested to Alamra he go along to make sure the man didn't find too much trouble. Alamra had said any trouble he found, he could handle alone. If Cat had pouted any harder, his lower lip would have tripped his hog. Oates couldn't say if Lucas had gone whoring, but he had certainly been drinking. He shambled into the foreyard, leading with his head and concentrating to keep his feet moving forward while also remaining beneath him. He almost passed Oates by, but noticed him at the last moment. His brain was too slowed by wine to be startled, though he did halt. Oates said nothing, feeling suddenly foolish. A big mongrel in nothing but his breeches sitting in the straw beside his hog in the middle of the night. hardly a sight to diminish the notion of half-orcs as swine-loving savages. Lucas gave a bubbling chuckle and moved on, but turned back after a few reeling steps.
"What do you want with him?" he asked.
"You want to slur that again?" Oates said.
"Rike,"
Lucas said, plodding closer.
"What do you want with him?"
Oates hesitated, but Lucas didn't wait for an answer. He raised an arm, tried and failed to aim an accusing finger.
"You won't use him!"
Oates couldn't deny Manrique was being used, but to have it thrown at him by this frail set his teeth to clenching. "Worried we'll do it better than you, fucker?" Lucas gawked at him.
"Better? I fear you'll be worse, Sootskin. You already are. He's no place here. Never wanted one. And now you uprooted him, tossed him into the cook pot, to be devoured."
"And it's his hide you're looking after, is it?" It took a moment for the jibe to penetrate the fog of wine. Lucas gave a hard blink.
"The hell's with you? He's a brother to me."
"I stand with my brothers. Don't leave them to face shit alone."
"Oh, yes. The fearsome thrice blood. Well, imagine, thrice blood, if you were one of your lesser brothers, smaller, weaker, and the powerful thrice blood refused to fight, always. Not for himself, not for you, for his entire life, your entire life. But you can't imagine it. Not you. Always strong. Always fighting."
The fatigue in Lucas's voice spread over Oates. "You're wrong, Frail. I know what it is to be weak. I ain't been the strongest of my brethren in a long time." Lucas swayed, sneered unhappily. He didn't seem to have heard. "You want help inside?" Oates asked. The sneer turned into a snarl, the drunk sudden flare of anger. Lucas rushed forward. Oates didn't bother to move. No way Lucas would cover the distance. Not without... He tripped and fell, hard, reflexes too slow to catch himself. His face hit the stones with a sound that made Oates wince. Besotted as he was, Lucas suffered more confusion than pain. He scrabbled face down for a moment before managing to roll over. His nose was gushing, making him cough. Oates hunched forward, grabbed the neck of the man's doublet, and dragged him closer. He lifted him to sitting. Lucas probed tenderly at his nose, slumped beside Oates and a little in front. Raising his fingers, he squinted at the blood.
"It was a fall," he mumbled at last.
"What it was," Oates agreed. Lucas craned to look at him, eyes unfocused.
"What happened to Rike? His face? It was a fall. Jerome threw him off a balcony. His own brother. Rike wasn't yet two."
Oates had a horrible image of Murrow tossing Wiley off some height. He shuddered, shook his head to rid himself of the thought. Fucking hells.
"He says he doesn't remember," Lucas went on. "I hope that's true. Jerome was sent away, never allowed near him again. Though, that proved..."
He blew a hiss from behind his teeth.
"All four I knew him. By then, Rike's father had taken Jerome's place as his tormentor. Giving him up for dead was the greatest kindness the old king ever did him."
"For dead?" Oates asked. Lucas nodded, turned away again.
"Rike ran off when he was six, escaped his nurses and tutors. He reached a farm. Don't know how long it took him, but if you and me, if we set out on foot from here right now, it would be 9 days before we arrived. My father found him in the pigsty, starving, nearly dead. Didn't know who he was. A filthy, big-boned boy with his squashed face didn't look to be a prince of the blood. I yearned for a brother, begged my parents not to take him to the steel friars. We didn't have much, so they feared defeat another. Barike proved a help, and big as he was, he didn't eat much. No matter how much my mother pressed, he never spoke of where he'd come from. Soon she gave up, and for 2 years we lived, the four of us, together.
Oates stayed quiet. The wine had become a river, powering the wheel of Lucas's tongue.
It was chance that he was found. Cruel chance, since it was Jerome that found him. To this day, I don't know what he was doing at the market fair, but he knew his brother, the face he'd created. Rike didn't know him, though, and Jerome was canny enough not to reveal his true self. But he looked a noble. Presented himself to my parents as a favorite of the king, thanked them with words for their care of the prince. Words and coin.
Lucas's mouth twisted in a way that made Oates fear he was about to vomit, but it was only bitter words that came spewing out.
The speed with which they gave him up. Now I see they were relieved not to be punished, but then it felt as if they sold him. My love for them withered in that moment, and I refused to let Rike go without me. Jerome could have done anything in that moment. Refused, accepted, and murdered me on the road. But he offered to bring me to court as the prince's companion. A better life. My father accepted with the same readiness. My mother asked for more coin. Perhaps she sought to offend, to force the withdrawal of the offer. I think so. And I think Jerome saw it too. But why take offense when you can make a mother's heart bleed? He gave them more for me than Rike, with a smile. As for Rike, he didn't protest, didn't try to run. He did what he has done since. Nothing. Fortunate for us, Jerome was exiled from court and hunted by the queen's bulls. Well, kings, then. Had it not been so, I suspect he might have slain us both for pleasure, or worse. But he used Manrique to buy back their father's favor.
Lucas looked at Oates once more.
And now he's being used again. Tell me, for what?
Peace in the lots, Oates said, and hoped he wasn't lying. Lucas huffed.
Ushered by Jerome's mongrel son. Forgive me if that doesn't lull me with comfort.
The man battled to his feet.
I wish I could make some oath. Tell you if anything befalls Manrique, I will see you pay. But they'd be empty words. I can't voice them to you any more than I could to the queen herself. He was only safe so long as he stayed far from here. Now.
Oates wanted to promise that no harm would come to the prince, but he didn't have the stomach for empty words either.
What would you have done, Lucas asked, if I'd reached you before?
These flagstones hit you a heap harder than I would have, Oates replied. Lucas touched his nose once more and dragged himself into the house. Oates was still sitting beside a snoring Ugfuck when the sun rose. The tourney began in earnest on the second day. Majirit's people flowed from the city and down the hill, coming in droves. They flooded the ground south of the field, pressing against the completed fence. Ale wagons provided by the crown dotted the crowd, islands in threat of being swallowed by the heaving tides of eager folk. The bastards were again given a place of honor with the queen on the viewing hill. Servants moving about at their backs, refilling goblets. The morning was cloudless, promising heat before noon. There were already men on horseback down on the field when Oates and the others arrived. They proved to be youths, jousting with thin, hollow lances. The nobles cheered and waved silk ribbons for their sons, but the commoners across the field were far more diverted by the ale. Oates couldn't blame them. Blue bloods with a few pubic hairs between them, timidly charging each other with reeds, wasn't much of a spectacle.
They care more for the bullfights, Queen Ursaria said.
She reached over to her right and placed a hand on Manrique's wrist.
I set those for the final day, knowing you detest them. And they make a morass of the field.
Oates, sitting on Manrique's other side, saw the man nod and give a weak smile, trying not to squirm at the queen's touch. She released him to cast a gentle, sweeping gesture at the field.
"Today we shall have the races, javelin hurl, and if there is light remaining, the first tilts."
Ursaria's face brightened. She cast a look at Alamra and then to Oates. Anyone else might have seemed a fool ass looking from side to side in such a manner, but for the queen the motion was practiced and supple.
"I have heard that one of your brothers was once a famed rider in the carnivales. Sebastian the Swain?"
"He is called Sluggard now, Majesty," Alamra answered.
Ursaria produced the smallest pout.
"Hardly fitting for one who never lost a pario. My master of Vittler's tells me I saw him perform once, but I admit I do not recall. It did make me wonder if your brothers would agree to ride in some of the games."
"Majesty?"
"The bloodless ones, of course. It would be a shame for the Lotlands not to take a part. There are knights from Guabia, Anvil, and it would do much to win the admiration of the people. Allow them to see the half-orcs of the Lots as more than frightening marauders."
"What a delight!"
Crafty exclaimed from beyond Alamra. Oates nearly barked at him to keep his mouth closed, but Rue spoke first.
"We would have to vote on this as a hoof, Majesty."
"Oh, do, but best be quick. These little lords will soon finish playing at war."
Alamra nodded and stood. Oates got up too, and they went to the side of the rise to descend. They said nothing as they turned to cross in front of the bottom tier. Thresh was the first to see them coming and alerted the rest. The bastard stood.
"Come,"
Alamra told them. The hoof went to the paddock set back behind the north side of the row of pavilions, where Hood stood watch over their hogs.
"The queen wishes us to take part in the games," Alamra said when they were all gathered.
Culprit's face scrunched.
"She wants us to knock them brats from the saddle?"
Polcat laughed.
"Oh, that'll be fun."
"No," Alamra said. "The events to come."
"We ain't considering that," Thresher said.
Her voice so heated, Oates couldn't tell if it was a question or a pronouncement.
"I told her we had to vote,"
Alamra replied. Polcat's hands shot up.
"In."
"Hold your fucking hog," Oates said. "Rue, what's she about, the queen?"
"The reasons she voiced were earnest," Alamra said. "We are here under the patronage of the prince, and these festivities are held in his honor. Refusing to participate would weaken the Lots in the eyes of the court and the commoners. As for what a refusal will do to Ursaria herself, I cannot say."
"Then we have to do it," Culprit said. "Chief didn't send us here to be milksops."
"She sent us to stop a fucking war," Thresh said, "not entertain the frails."
"I'm afraid the two are not riven," Alamra said. "I cannot say for certain the queen lacks other motivations. In truth, it would be strange if she did not. As ruler, her concerns will be myriad. It bears mention that she did broach the matter by way of Sluggard and his past with the man Barasa."
All eyes went to Sluggard, who had been as silent and still as Hoodwink. "Slug," Oates prodded. "You got any arguments?" Sluggard shook his head, ridding himself of a pensive stare.
"No. No, I say we do it."
"That's two," Polcat said, smiling.
"It's a fucking no from me and Anvil," Thresher declared.
"Oh, right," Culprit rubbed his head. "I have Warbler's vote."
"Shit.
Well, he hates fun, so no for him. Me, yes." Oates grunted. "This is just the sort of hog shit Jackal would rush to do, but Crafty was in favor, so that would flip his mind. No for Jack. As for the chief, I reckon she'd follow Alamra on this."
"I would tell her we should."
"Hood," Polcat said. "Time to move your head in one of two ways." Hoodwink did. It was a no, leaving Oates the deciding vote.
Hells. Why hadn't he just voiced his preference along with fetchings and jackals? Because he didn't damn know then, or now. The minds of queens, the intrigues of court, What did he know about any of it? Precisely nothing. He was a lot-born mongrel. A bastard. A hoof rider. That's what he knew, how he thought. No sense in doubting that now.
Oates took a long breath. Saddle up. Chapter 33. A volley of hisses greeted the true bastards as they took the tourney field. The jeers intensified as they rode a circuit around the edge, following the riders from Majeth. Numbering only 10 men, the Majethi had been delighted to find they were no longer the smallest in number, and therefore, no longer the rear of the procession. Theirs were the only smiles among the competing frails when the hoof arrived in the marshalling field behind the noble's terrace. The Hispartans wore scowls and mustachios, the Anvilis sneers and long locks, the Guabians stone faces behind aggressively styled beards. The crown's cavaleros caused a roar when they trotted onto the field, 80 men in scale coats lifting their javelins in salute to the queen. And these were the lesser houses, the men without land, coin, and title enough to merit a place in the joust. Sluggard had explained it all while they waited to enter the field. "And so they try to garner attention in the tavolato," he said. "Which is throwing a javelin at a wooden target?" Culbert asked, still convinced there had to be more to it. There wasn't. Portable palisades made of boards were already standing at staggered intervals in the field center when the procession emerged. Each rider was to charge one at a gallop, fling a javelin, and knock the target down. Any that failed were removed from the contest. There were only 20 targets, so the tavolato was held in rounds, servants running out to reset the fallen palisades after each run and to retrieve the javelins. Half the targets were reserved for Hisparta's men at each run. The bastards were given a single spot at the end nearest the queen's terrace. Thresher demanded to go first.
"Get this over with," she muttered.
The hoof was also given the shortest run up to the target, robbing their mounts a chance to build up speed to aid with the cast. It didn't matter. When a horn blast signaled the first run, Thresh kicked her hog forward, barely left a trot, and threw with an almost languid motion, striking her target true and sending it flopping over. Culprit blew air from between his lips.
"The hells? This ain't shit."
But Sluggard pointed out several targets across the field still standing. Two Hisparthans and the first Majethi had failed. All those who succeeded their run were supposed to ride in front of the terrace steps and salute the queen, but Thresher turned her hog in a tight loop and rode directly back to the hoof. The crowd was not pleased.
"Can I go now?" Thresh asked over the harsh din.
Oates didn't bother to answer. She knew she had to keep with her brothers. True to Culprit's derision, the tavolato proved simple for the bastards. The javelins used were lighter than those they wielded in the lots, something they had all noted when given the weapons. A few quick words of advice from Thresh while the targets were being reset helped prepare the rest of them. Oates was the only one to nearly fail the first run, throwing his javelin clear through the target with such force it almost didn't fall. He couldn't be certain, but he thought he heard a change in the crowd's voice as he rode by the nobles, lifting his fist at Alamra. It was Sluggard's run that won them in earnest. He waited a moment after the horn and seemed to be watching the Majethi rider to his left, already spurring forward. Sluggard spurred Pala, made his cast, and knocked the target down. He immediately drew a second javelin and threw crosswise, striking the target the Majethi had failed to bring down, correcting the man's mistake. The common folk erupted with cheers and laughter. The Blue Bloods couldn't help but do the same when Sluggard made his ride before the terrace, reclining on Pala's back, head nestled behind his hands in the pig's mane. Even Thresher's foul mood was lightened by that display of balance and assery. After all had taken a run, the targets were rearranged, and the number to be struck increased. The second run demanded the riders fell two, then three in the third, the positioning and distance adding to the challenge. The frails were culled deeply in the second run, and by the third, the bastards began to falter. Polecat missed once on his three-target run. Thresh struck all three, but one remained stubbornly upright. Oates and Culprit failed at 4. Only 3 men reached the 5 target run, 2 Hisparthans and 1 of the Guabians. Sluggard and Hoodwink remained for the lots.
"This will decide it," Polcat said, shielding his brow from the sun.
The targets were arranged in a tight cluster, 3 forward and a pair flanking. The approach was almost the length of the field.
"Your first cast needs to be made midfield at the latest," Cat went on. "Else you won't have time for the rest. Even then," he clicked his tongue.
"Ever hit 5? Culprit asked Sluggard.
"Hit?" Slug replied, stretching his shoulder.
"Yes."
"Knocked over?"
"No."
"What about you, Hood?"
"It is one less than an Ulyud," Hoodwink stated.
The horn blared, sending the first cavalero into a gallop. He waited too long to cast and struck only 3 targets down before reaching the end of the run. The Guabian struck 4, but only a pair fell. Sluggard was next. He sent Pallas surging forth. His first cast came just before midfield and cut a perfect arc, landing on the upper half of the middle target, slamming it down. The next javelin was in the air before the first struck. Oates cheered with the others as another target fell. Sluggard was nearly even with the 3rd palisade when he threw. At that distance, there was little chance of missing. The 4 splintered the boards. Just the pair sitting beyond remained. Pala's speed brought Sluggard to them swiftly. Too swiftly. He managed to get a 4th javelin off, knocking the target down, but he wasn't quick enough for the 5th. Still, he nudged Pala deftly at the last moment, and the hog knocked it over with a sweep of his tusk as he passed. Another burst of laughter and roar of approval went up from the rabble. Sluggard returned to the hoof with a bright grin.
"Doesn't count," he said, weathering the backslaps. "But I was inspired by Hood's vision of them as orcs."
The Hisparthans wanted one of their own for last, so that put Hoodwink up.
"Good luck," Culprit told him as he guided his hog to the start of the run.
One of the Majethi riders spurred closer.
6 drachmi he fail,
the man called and accented his Spartan. The true bastards all answered at the same time.
Done. Agreed. Take that wager.
Get ready to pay.
Like poverty, fucker?
Oates found he was holding his breath as Hood waited for the horn. It sounded. Hood kicked his hog, but held it back from the speed Slug had goaded from Pala. His first cast was a mirror of Sluggard's. The next 2 targets fell so quickly, Oates barely saw the javelins fly. The front 3 were down and the back pair closing. Hoodwink put a javelin in each hand and threw both in perfect unison. The targets slapped to the ground and the field erupted with hearty shouts. Hells, he'd made it look easy. Face twisted with rancor, the Majethi returned to his companions to gather the coin and receive several slaps to the face. Hoodwink made the customary ride by the terrace, but followed his own custom of offering nothing more, keeping his gaze ahead and his hands on his hog. Polecat was already distributing the coins among the hoof when Hood rode up.
"Reckon you get one too,"
Cat told him with a pleased grin, tossing the silver disc. Hood snatched it out of the air. The last Hisparthan was up.
7 drachmi he fail,
the Majethi called.
No chance. Fuck off. Eat an entire cock. Nice try. How's my ass taste?
No.
The Cavalero made his run. And the hostility he earned from the crowd after bringing down only 3 targets was louder than the bastards received when they entered the field. With a wide smile, Sluggard dipped his head at the coin still in Hoodwink's hand.
You just earned a heap more than that.
How much? Culprit asked, breathless and beaming. Sluggard shrugged.
We'll have to wait until tonight. The queen grants all prizes herself, and you'll have to sit up on the top and dine with her.
Don't worry, Hood. I'll be up there with you after I win the pario, though I suggest you forego the race. These frails will be looking for a little comeuppance. They'll be eager to keep you from collecting.
They can try, Hoodwink said.
Yes, but we don't need any of them dead, Oates said. No race for you, Hood, and none for me either. Ugfuck wouldn't thank me for putting him in something like that. The rest of you can make your own choice.
Polecat swatted Culprit on the chest.
What do you say, young blood?
Try and stop me. Thresher dismounted and started leading her hog back to the paddocks.
Try not to die, fool asses.
Oates retook his seat at the queen's table. The looks he'd received from the court during his ascent ranged from open contempt to grudging respect. One woman had raised her goblet to him with a coy smile and appraising eyes. After that, he kept his eyes ahead.
A fine showing, strong Oates,
Crafty proclaimed, clapping his ring-laden hands. Oates shuffled behind the wizard's chair without a word.
I am so happy you chose to compete, the queen said as he sat. Wonderful! That pale rider is a marvel.
She looked to Elamra.
Hoodwink, was it? Yes, your majesty. Wonderful,
Ursaria repeated. She returned her attention to Oates, leaning forward to see past Manrique.
You and your brothers did so well. Do you have a similar sport in the lots?
We hunt orcs, Oates said.
Ursaria laughed.
Of course. Wine so early makes me a fool. Perhaps it should also be obvious to me why you are not entering the race?
My hog is lazy.
He was only speaking in earnest, but received another laugh.
And barbarians don't mix well with horses. Reckoned it best to keep our numbers small.
Yes, Volador and some others expressed alarm. They advised against allowing your hogs in the pario, but that is silliness. If we can contest each other in Ulwandulas, surely we can risk doing so here. Would you not agree?
Reckon so, Oates answered.
If the queen caught his focus shifting to Elamra, she gave no sign. Rue's calm mask held the smallest mote of apprehension. Wooden poles affixed to stands were now being set up below. Coils of rope festooned with bright ribbons were tied between the poles to create a circuit around the field. The queen brushed Manrique lightly with the back of her hand.
Who do you favor to win?
I have no favorite, the prince replied, his glance weighing less than her touch.
Oh, come. No wager on one of the true bastards? Does your patronage not extend to confidence in their prowess?
I've no taste for betting. Letting the matter go, Ursaria shifted her smile to Crafty, who was all too ready to reflect it with his own.
Surely you are not so demure, Emir Ultani? I take pride in never being so, gentle queen. So then, for whom shall we cheer? I would not dare suggest Her Majesty lift her voice for any but a son of Hisparta,
Crafty replied with exuberant playfulness. The preparations upon the field were nearing completion, and the riders began to assemble at the left end of the field, closest to the terrace. Oates noticed that few of the Anvilis and none of the Guabians were present, though all 10 of the Majethi were there. It appeared most of the cavaleros from the Tavolado were eager to regain some honor. The lane denoted by the hastily erected ropes wasn't wide enough for every rider to race abreast, but unlike the last contest, it looked as if all would compete at the same time. Oates wasn't certain how the positions were determined, but his brothers sat their hogs at the front and upon the outward edge. Sluggard spoke to Cat and Culprit, making gestures with his hands to illustrate whatever advice he was intent on providing.
But what of you?
The queen pressed Crafty.
What demands your own acclamations? Do you cheer for Majeth, an island ruled by the empire you serve? Or the mongrels, for you are one yourself?
Or Hisparta, Crafty added with good cheer. Home of my father and source of my human blood.
The queen made no reply, though her silence displayed no discomfort, only a confident patience.
I need not choose, Crafty said. To cheer for Majeth is to cheer for Hisparta, for the sultans have empowered me to make you a gift of the island, most glorious queen. As for the Lotlands, I have come with no other purpose but to employ my voice on their behalf, and so I shall. Knowing that to bellow heartily for their success does nothing to decry your great kingdom, for we are here to make peace. By inviting our friend Hoofriders to take part, you have provided the spirit of this contest, Majesty. As you predicted, the cheers of the people begin to knit. All of us, I am thinking, shall be impressed and enlivened by the winner, whoever it may be.
Ursaria plucked her goblet from the table and raised it toward Crafty.
Well said. Majesty, the wizard replied, lifting his own cup.
The signal horn took Oates by surprise. Flinging his attention back to the field, he found the riders thundering forward, those at the fore breaking swiftly away while the dense pack behind jostled for position, some struggling to get moving. Sluggard, Culprit, and Polecat had nothing but open ground before them and made a good start, but horses were faster from the kick, and several frails dashed ahead. Sluggard had said the race was 8 circuits, and a hog could outpace any horse, given time. Speed, it turned out, wasn't the only consideration. While no weapons were allowed in the pario, there was nothing to prevent the riders from shoving and punching, methods playing out in a fury among the tight press fighting to break loose. Oates saw several riders knocked from bucking horses, creating a clog among the racers. Across the field, the commoners were building to a furor, fed by the conflict playing out under the nobles' noses. The cries of the blue bloods were only lesser due to their smaller numbers, but from where Oates sat, their outpour of excitement was close to ear-splitting. The noise caused Manrique to cringe. Chin tucked, he watched only from the corner of one eye. The queen looked on with fixed concentration and raised her voice, but it wasn't a shout or a cheer.
Tell me of your chieftain, the fabled she-devil. Fletching, is it?
Oates wasn't sure whom she was asking, but it was Alamra who answered, her response almost swallowed by the howling court.
Fetching, your majesty. Oh, she is comely then. She is magnificent, majesty.
High praise coming from one who looks as you.
Careful, you will make me hate this fetching. The first are coming around.
Down on the field, the lead horsemen were a turn away from completing their first circuit, barreling toward the clot that had not yet cleared from the start. Some unhorsed men were foolish enough to remain on the track, attempting to wrangle their spooked animals. Others were sprawled in the sparse grass, hardly visible through the haze of dust. It would take a keen rider to pass through the ever-changing gaps without incident. Oates saw the boon of the starting position turn into a detriment as the lead man, one of the Majethi on a mare, collided with a rearing stallion. Both horses toppled in a flailing of legs and screams. Oates heard Manrique's pained gasp through the baying nobles.
Is it true she is a sorceress?
Ursaria asked, stretching forward in her seat to witness the Majethi crawl free from the fallen horses and scurry to flee the track. It was a moment before Alamra answered. Oates reckoned that her attention, like his own, was seized by their brethren coming around the first turn. They had stuck together, Polecat and Sluggard acting as flank guards for Culprit. They formed a stout arrowhead, but split up as they came around. The hogs could have cut an easy swath through the splintered obstacles of men and horses, but this was no band of fixed to slay. Avoiding bloodshed, the bastards threaded through the turmoil and won free, gaining the straight fronting the terrace once more.
The hogs are nimbler than one would expect, the queen exclaimed. Well, is she?
Of a kind, Alamra replied. She has the blood of elves. It is said she rides a great raptor and cannot be pierced by steel.
That is so, yet she was formidable long before she came to such power, tempered by suffering and the harshness of the lots. She was not welcome among the hoofs, yet she earned her place, and now all mongrel riders call her chief.
War chief, I believe you mean. We hope that title may be soon set aside.
That will be difficult if she continues to attack our castles and cities without provocation. Ah, the pario now truly begins. The start is always little more than a brawl.
A brawl that knocked close to a score from the race. Servants in the center of the track now risked ducking the ropes to help men and horses get clear. The fallen Majethi horse lay with a broken leg. A man hurried out with a stockbow to end its suffering. Manrique lurched to his feet and fled the terrace. Oats saw Crafty give Fuktus a small signal, and the demon followed the prince down the steps.
"Majesty," Alamra said, "half-orcs were being hunted and slain by cavaleros without cause."
The queen made no reply, her rapt attention on the race. Oats could no longer tell which of the frails led, the fastest now intermingled with the slowest. Some were in their second circuit, others still the first. A rider could not claim victory until the seventh, but Oats was fucked if he'd know when that was. His brothers were on the second, he knew that much. And the way the nobles carried on, shouting encouragement and insults at various men by name, they knew where their favorites stood. Of the bastards, Culprit was farthest ahead, but he was pushing his hog too hard, saving none of the sow's fire for the final stretches. It looked as if Polecat was shouting at the younger mongrel, trying to caution him, but Culprit was heedless. Sluggard had fallen back so Paula could hug the inner ropes. It would make the turns tighter, but reduce the lengths.
"There was cause, surely,"
the queen said over the tumult of pounding hooves and lusty voices.
"As you said, the Lotlands are harsh, lawless. I need not tell you that all who dwell there are surrounded by peril. Orcs and centaurs and elves, killers and savages are the crop of Ulwandulas. It takes brave men to endure there. I cannot imagine you would fault them for doing what they must to protect themselves, to survive."
A cavalero caught up to Polecat on his left and lashed out with an arm. Cat warded the blow with his own arm, and his return strike almost knocked the man from the saddle. The cavalero scrambled to stay a horse and fell behind once more. Cat continued to gain ground. The mongrels entered the third circuit within heartbeats of one another. Alamra was silent. Oats reckoned she knew better than he, but he chewed on the gristle of angry words. Brave men. The cavaleros were exiles led by criminals and madmen. Ignacio was a slaver, Bermudo a haughty fuck blinded by hate. And then there was whatever stripe of loon Manetto had been. The lots were well served with them in the dust. Hard to fathom his Sparta wasn't better off being rid of them in the bargain. The crowd roared as an Anvilis rider fell from the saddle during a turn. Sluggard, on the inside, was now even with Culprit, who occupied the middle of the track. Four horsemen separated Polecat from his brothers, but he was on the verge of passing one, staying out of arm's reach. Crafty spoke up.
"A war between your kingdom and the Lots is a boon for none but Dargest, good queen."
"It could be argued Tyrkania as well,"
Ursaria said, smiling at the spectacle below.
"East of Tradria, only the Halicians remain to oppose the Empire, and I am told their resistance will soon crumble."
"The Sultans only wish to
claim the world,"
Ursaria cut him off pleasantly.
"A lion devours, it rests. That is its nature. My half-brother may believe such a beast can be kept and tamed, but I am not so callow, Emir Ultani. Tyrkania may be resting now, but that does not mean it will not soon slaver for Hisparta."
"My masters dared hope the gift of my Jeth would help convince your majesty the empire is not the ravenous monster it appears."
Ursaria laughed, a throaty, genial sound.
"One tiny island passed between kings and conquerors since before the Imperium. Far from attempting